Welcome to Vermont Movement News, Volume 3, Episode 1. It's been a long time since we were on the internet. We felt that the recent wave of bigotry and the anti-CRT and anti-trans panics need to be answered strongly. Daryl Lamont Jenkins, Executive Director of the One People's Project, will be co-host. In this episode, we will be interviewing Brian McCray, a teacher of photography, video production, and graphic design at North Country Union High School. He's also been a social studies teacher, and that's located in Newport, Vermont, up near the Canadian border. Vermont has a reputation for liberalism and progressive values. However, it has not been immune against the far right's crusade against anti-racist values and tolerance. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us about a little bit about your background, Brian, before we get started.
Well, I actually grew up in this area. It's always been though, like a more conservative part of the state. Back in the old days, Republicans held sway in the state of Vermont, and my great-grandfather was a Republican representative. But the values have changed greatly. I don't know if you guys were familiar with Pat Leahy, who was, not Pat Leahy, but Jim Jeffords, who was the senator before, you know, Bernie took his slot. And he was a Republican, but he's pro-education. And when I went to University of Vermont, I was one of the first people to come out of the Air Force with this new benefits package that came under President Carter. And he jumped right in there and got a general down at the Pentagon to get me my benefits. And that's the kind of stuff that I respected him for. And I could respect, I've voted, you know, I've been an independent, I've voted on both sides, but, you know, that's getting more and more difficult today because, you know, I feel that there's been a major shift in that party.
I was thinking, you mentioned Jim Jeffords and you mentioned the kind of like progressiveness of him. And I think about New England in general, and it is curious because as you go, you have New Hampshire and you have Maine, which are still relatively conservative. Once you start going to Vermont and all that, do you start seeing kind of like, was there always like a gray area when it came to Vermont that is now becoming more and more progressive? Or, because I have never been to Vermont.
Oh, well, let me tell you. You know, my ancestors have lived here for a long time. We settled here in the 1770s. And Vermont has been a place where there's been the house where my mom grew up was owned by an abolitionist priest who was a stop on the Underground Railroad. And, you know, you've got people like Alexander Twilight, who was the first African-American to receive a college degree in the United States. Mm. So you've got that. I mean, but really, there's this gradient. It's more conservative in the northeast part of the state. And then the Champlain Valley, where you've got like the major population centers in and around Burlington, where the college town, you know, it's a college town, you've got, you know, a younger population. It's much more progressive. I mean, Bernie Sanders was the mayor when I was in college there, you know, and that, you know, that part of the state has always, you know, been the most progressive. And that's where the largest, you know, chunk of the population is. So there's a gradient, I think, from east to west.
And do you see, I mean, I think I just asked this. Just going to say, I know, actually, I would like to ask, do you notice anything? Because this is important for the upcoming election. I mean, a lot of people are looking at the possibility of making things a little bluer in Maine and in New Hampshire this go around. Do you see that even happening in places like New Hampshire and Maine? Do you see the influence of the rest of New England affecting things that are going on or what happened? What you say?
Yeah, I think the frustration that I have is it's so much disinformation out there, and there are people who are fed this completely different narrative in some of these places. And, you know, I've tried to have discussions with people but it's really difficult discussing things with them when they have like a completely different base of knowledge. And a lot of it is based on wacky conspiracy theories. Sometimes you've got QAnon people, and yeah, you know, it's really discouraging. As a one-time government teacher, you know, I believe in democracy. I believe in the idea of everybody having a voice and people having their own say in their own destiny and deciding how their tax money is spent. And that's got a long history in America and going all the way back to English law. But it's interesting. I think what you're seeing today is, you know, it's the classic, you know, Hobbes versus Locke, you know, argument. Thomas Hobbes said that humanity is this unruly mass and you need some kind of strong dictator to run things and crack the whip over people. And then Locke thought, you know, people were intelligent enough to make their own decisions. And I think that has been part of the reason for the attack on education, this idea of, you know, that we're teaching something radical in schools that's somehow anti-American. Also the idea, I hate the idea that, you know, the former president accused educators of hating our country. I mean, I've served in the military, and, you know, every generation of my family has, going all the way back to the American Revolution, and we believe in the country. But what I do believe is in democracy and everybody having a say, but, you know, that carries a responsibility with it. I think that's what Benjamin Franklin meant after the Constitution was written, and he was asked if, you know, what kind of a government do we have? And he said, we've got a, you know, we've got a republic if we can keep it. And that means that it's up to all of us to understand the issues and make the most of everybody. I mean, right now it seems like everything seems to be driven by fear. It's that Machiavellian, it's better to be feared than loved, you know, like as a ruler. The thing that discourages me is, I mean, I've had blowback, you know, when I was teaching social studies for parents for teaching that one lesson. I talked about Locke versus Hobbes, and I'd written an article in my blog, and we discussed it in class, and I had two parents like object to that. You know, they didn't want to talk about, you know, ideas like that. We just, you know, should just blindly, you know, follow the president and what's being said rather than being able to debate things and discuss things. And so, yeah, you know, that's the thing that I worry about. There's this intimidation involved where election officials are being like called up and threatened. You know, I just read the book, This Will Not Pass. And, you know, when I looked at the impeachment hearings in detail, people like Mitt Romney that voted for impeachment called the police to go and protect his family because he knew that they'd be under threat. And there's this kind of underlying intimidation theme that's, you know, really quite frightening. When I was in the Air Force station over in Germany, I remember having
What base were you on?
I was at Lindsay Air Station, which is this tiny little postage stamp sized base in Wiesbaden.
I am so old. I mean, I was in the Air Force too. I was there in from like 87 to 80 to 89, but I do not remember that base. I was Ramstein.
Yeah. Ramstein was there. I was postal, so like I remember all the APO codes. Ramstein was 09012. I was there from 79 to 81.
Okay.
And you know, during that, you know, that's the thing. Like the place that I come from, like up here, used to be very white. I mean, you never saw people of color up here. But, you know, 40, 50 years ago, you never heard, you know, the N-word ever, you know, and you never saw, you know, kids going around like flying the Confederate flag in the back of their pickup truck or wearing it on a T-shirt. That kind of stuff has, you know, been introduced like, you know, recently. Like we were like, you know, those guys were the rebels. They were our enemies. Our ancestors, you know, fought those guys. And now that's like part of this this culture that's been growing, and it's caused the intimidation. I think that a lot of people on the left are feeling. Of course, they would say, well, you got Antifa out there, and there's so many of them, and they're just as bad as the Proud Boys or the Oath Keepers. And how are you going to argue against something that's been like programmed into those folks?
One thing I was hearing is the high school students were having a protest in Newport regarding the school shootings on,
right.
I think it was last Saturday. And I spoke with the young woman who was organizing, a Black woman, a high school student. And I was hearing that there was quite a lot of racial intimidation towards her. And
yes,
in the high school.
I believe she's somebody that was one of my students. She also organized, if it's the same person, I was in Colorado when that protest took place, but she organized a memorial for the students that were killed at Uvalde. And she's a really, sweet, compassionate person, who cares about others. And I just remember one of the first, few days that I had her in class, there was a kid that was upset, and I remember giving her a hug, like that's the kind of person she is. And she said that she had, same person says that she's faced, racial discrimination and bigotry. And, I told her, I said, this is all recent. This is all stuff that's grown from this toxic political climate. This just seemed to, explode over the last few years. It didn't exist here 40, 50 years ago. And, I'm worried about it because, like, can I say, Daryl, when I was in the Air Force over in Germany, I remember talking to people that, were old timers and had been around when, like, Hitler took over. And, I just remember thinking, that'll never happen in the United States because, we got a good education system here. People know what's going on. They take democracy seriously. And a part of my thing was in the military, I was definitely a minority coming from Vermont. The only other guy that was from Vermont on Lindsay Air Station was the base pastor. He was like from Island Pond, Vermont, all places. Everybody else was from different places all over the country. And some of the guys, spoke Spanish as their first language, and there were people of color. I was the only white guy in the office, the first place that I worked, but like, we're all family, like holidays and birthdays and whatever, we get together and be each other's family. And that's the America that I yearn for, is like where everybody gets along. Everybody has an equal chance.
Well, we've always had problems like that.
I mean,
even in our day. Even in our day, back in the 80s, Reagan was really laying the groundwork for this kind of thing to happen. I mean, and along with the white supremacists that were like waiting in the wings, like William Pierce, I was talking with somebody a while back, and we're just saying that, hey, this is exactly what William Pierce wanted. And for those who don't know, William Pierce was the founder of the National Alliance, a white neo-Nazi organization.
Yeah.
He was the author of the Turner Diaries. And everything, and basically what you see right now is the kind of machinations that he had been trying to put together, where you have your your thugs in the street, Proud Boys, and you have your politicians, and you have your activists.
Yeah.
He's been looking for that for years. That's why he was trying to hook up with the quote unquote skinheads back in the day. He couldn't stand the quote unquote skinheads, but he saw them as useful idiots. And that's pretty much where you see the Proud Boys.
Right, yeah.
And the Oath Keepers and all of that. And and any of the QAnon knuckleheads out there.
That's
what you see. Well, QAnon is more or less the activist of it. So
one thing, let me chime in here. One thing that's important to note as far as the guy that founded the National Alliance, his biographer was an education teacher from the University of Vermont. Robert Griffin was Pierce's biographer, and he's become kind of a very silent grandfather slash uncle to the white supremacist movement, particularly the people around here. That guy, Ryan Roy, who lost his job after Charlottesville, Griffin's apartment was just up from the pizza shop that he worked at.
That's interesting. I didn't even know that about Griffin. I didn't realize he was in Vermont, but it speaks to what you're talking about. I mean, I think that there's a lot that we can take out of that, considering what's been going on in Vermont. I mean, it is still a progressive state, but it has its issues.
Yeah.
I mean, we saw what happened to Keir Morris, for example, and that influence and the thing, and more to the point, we see how hesitant they were to dealing with Max Meech in general, not just in regards to Ms. Morris, but also in regards to all the things all the laws he was breaking while out on bail.
Yeah, yeah.
That they would not violate him for. And I sit there and everybody was just sitting there looking at it going, he's been arrested 8 times since being out on bail, a couple of those times felonies, and you're not locking him up?
Right.
And now I think it's just house arrest right now, isn't it?
Last I heard, yeah, he's been kind of quiet since the last time he was in court.
Yeah, because people are saying because that was the last time he was in court was just after the first time people saying, OK, we're doing a count. This is 8 people. So once that started going on, everybody was like, OK, fine, we'll lock him up. But you know, but obviously they don't want to do it for real. Who else will get house arrest?
Yeah.
Bad news. We also get in trouble 8 times while out on bail, but then again, that's just me. I go to Providence, Rhode Island quite a bit, and I see, and I go back and forth between Boston and Providence to do a little bit of work. I think today there's supposed to be a pro-choice rally, and they're concerned about NSC 131. That's the Nationalist Social Club, and 131 stands for Anti-Communist Action. Mm-hmm. They're supposed to be, everybody wants to see if they show up and try to cause some grief. And they have been, they've had a pretty steady presence in Boston. But Chris Hood got arrested this week, the leader of NSC. And, you know, it's probably just a misdemeanor that'll get dismissed, or he'll just have to pay a fine or whatever. But it speaks to the fact that they are a little bit more prominent. I'm going to hesitate and say and not say brazen, because brazen would mean they will be doing more than just putting stickers on light posts and wearing masks when it's when no one else is. You know, that's not brazen. They're grasping at straws, and the reason for that, it must be said now, the reason for that is that we are trying to push back against what we're seeing out there. And I wanted to ask you, Brian, what kind of efforts have you seen that would suggest that?
Try to push back.
What kind of things have you seen people do to say, no, we're not going to do this, we're not going to have this?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Since, you know, the days of the media being accused of fake news and educators being accused of, you know, like hating our country and teaching some kind of radical ideas. And one of the things that I teach is, you know, what socialism is, you know, like versus it's interesting because I think people's concept of socialism is it's always a dictatorship, you know, like that's always the example that's given. You know, they don't talk about countries like you know, Canada and the United Kingdom and France and Germany, the other mixed economies that have a degree of the economy that's paid for by taxes. And, you know, the healthcare thing, you know, how long can the insurance and pharma industries, you know, keep this wall up where people don't realize they pay twice as much as everybody else? I try to tell them, you know, it's not socialism that you need to be worried about. It's dictatorship. And dictatorship is when, you know, you believe in the leader's narrative and you don't listen to the media and you don't listen to, unless it's the approved media, you don't listen to, you know, what others have to say. You don't listen to other people's experience, people of, you know, of color who may have, you know, experienced discrimination, or anybody that's different anyhow. It seems to be brewing in this atmosphere, you know, these days. It's that kind of thought that's going to lead us down the path to some kind of dictatorship if people don't kind of wake up and see what's going on. One of the things I recently read in a book, it's called How the World Got Rich, and it was just like published. And it's basically the whole idea is the world's accumulated most of its wealth in the last 200 years. And part of that has come about because of more democratic types of government. Government where you had, like, you know, autocracies or absolute monarchs, they're extractive. You keep people in servitude either, you know, through you know, feudal type system or slavery, and a very few benefit while everybody else labors. And the reason that we're as wealthy as we are today is because more people, you know, are productive, and we're using all our brains. We're firing on more cylinders than we used to, you know, combined with, you know, the explosion in technology that's taken place. And, you know, people don't seem to realize that, you know, a type of political philosophy that limits everybody but one group keeps us from being at our best. It's like an engine not firing on all cylinders, and everybody's important. You know, that's a thing I liked about, like, when I was in the service, I got to meet folks from all different walks, and they all had, you know, brothers and sisters and parents that loved them, and they were other human beings. And they, you know, we spent holidays together and Thanksgivings and Christmases while we were, you know, stationed overseas. And I never thought back then that we'd be in the place that we are today, you know, where there's so much division and so much mistrust. And it makes me sad.
Marina?
I've been hearing a lot about high school student teachers actually being victimized by these radical right activists, particularly in the district south of Newport. Do you have anything to say about that? And I am.
I've heard about that. You know, I experienced a little bit of it. I know when, you know, now I'm teaching art, and I was in this sculpture class, and a couple of girls were talking about how, you know, one of my friends that's a social studies teacher was so careful, you know, in discussing things in class. And I know personally that, you know, I saw this letter that he'd gotten from a parent that was just, you know, ripping him up one side and down the other. And I took a course on trauma over this past winter. And it was interesting. There was a woman of color who was a counselor in a Vermont school, was taking the class, and she was leaving the state because she couldn't deal with what she was having to put up with. And I felt so badly because I'm like, you know, damn, we need more of you people in here so that people can see your humanity. But people refuse to see it. And that makes me sad. You know, you've got these people who would organize these protests or memorials, and they're being targeted because they think that they're somehow different. One thing that's sort of interested me, when I was in college, I studied archaeology and anthropology. If I hadn't studied abroad in Scotland for a year, I probably would have had enough credits to be a minor in anthropology. And one of the things that's interested me that, you know, now that we've, you know, decoded the genome, like people that lived in, you know, Scotland and Ireland where my ancestors came from had dark skin 5,000 years ago. I mean, it's not all, you know, that long ago. You know, I've got some Neanderthal DNA. So there was some kind of love there or something, you know. And you think, gosh, you know, yeah, it's just a shame. It's just a shame that this stuff is coming up now. And you know, we were in a situation where it's kind of endorsed, you know, by certain politicians and they're running on kind of a, you know, white supremacist ideal.
In my very neighborhood, on my road, which has people who work at the school district, we were tagged with swastikas last summer. So I was out scrubbing those off with a wire brush shortly after that, because I walk on that road and I don't want to see that. Have you been seeing that? I had to remove a fascist sticker in Newport last weekend from a group called Patriot Front.
Right.
Near the fish. We scrubbed that off during that demonstration. What can you talk about these actual groups that are organizing to do this kind of stuff?
Well, you know, like I said, you know, that the Confederate flag all of a sudden be, you know, people flying the Confederate flag or flags just with obscenities on them, you know, like when did that become?
When they stopped caring, that happened.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of people, I think, that care, Daryl, you know.
I'm talking about the ones who fly those kinds of flags.
Yeah. You know, we care. And it's not something that we want to see. Like, for instance, during the last election, you saw, like, you know, this is a conservative part of the state. You saw a lot of, you know, pro-Trump signs and whatever. And one thing that I noticed is, like, every now and then you'd see, like, a Biden sign and... You know, there was one driving up to the school and it only lasted a day or two before it was in like the ditch. you know, somebody else had a Biden sign posted and, you know, had it vandalized. And you don't see people vandalizing the Trump things, you know. And same thing like with the election officials who are being criticized or teachers who are being criticized for, you know, teaching radical ideas or whatever it is that they think that we're doing, it is one-sided. And it is sort of a, well, it's like the, you know, you hear the stories from the days of, you know, Nazis and fascists under Mussolini where, you know, neighbors were, you know, turning in their other neighbors and people were ruled by fear. They were afraid to speak their conscience sometimes. And that was one thing that I read in this book. There was a lot of coercion of these, you know, Republican representatives that voted against impeachment. They and their families were being threatened. And it's like, you know, on that side of things, it seems. And,
weren't you meaning they're voting for impeachment?
Voting against the impeachment, you know, that some of them were hoping that he would be impeached, but they voted for it, hoping, you know, that somehow there would be a majority of votes. But they were worried about their families. You know, families were being threatened, you know, and this is... You know, when you let this kind of ideology in, it invites that kind of hate. Yeah, you know, and it's hard to convince people that you know a lot of this Antifa stuff is a myth. It just doesn't compare to the amount of stuff that's negativity that and threats and bullying that's coming from the other side.
People accuse me of organizing people to burn towns, and yes, I am of an Antifa supporter. Done a lot.
And I'm
of
just
stuff.
Flat out Antifa.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. They think that we have an organized hierarchy when.
Well, remember, I'm supposed to be the leader of all.
yeah.
So, but it's what I always tell people is that, hey, if you don't like fascism, if you don't like to see, like what's going on out there right now, that makes you anti-fascist. That makes you anti-fascist.
Right. Yeah. But you're not gonna. I'm not gonna call you up and threaten your family because you know you're teaching something or you're doing your job as a representative putting in a vote because you're an elector or that kind of stuff. It's scary. It's like mob rule.
I didn't know how long, Marina, you wanted to go with this.
Generally another 25 minutes, if that's okay with you.
Oh, that's fine. Cause I know you want to talk about, maybe we should talk about, cause you, Brian brought up how the attack on education.
Yeah.
And it was something that, is kind of like near and dear to my heart, considering that, education is pretty much my family business.
Yeah. Mine too. Yeah. Both my parents were teachers. And my grandmother was a teacher. Mm-hmm. Education is really, all we have. And one thing that I've seen with, sometimes you'll have a student that comes in with a computer that has, you know, the Trump stickers all over it. And they are not, they're going to pass with the lowest possible grade that they need to get through it. You know, and they're resistant because they're being told they're being indoctrinated that, you know, the stuff that they're being taught is all rubbish. It's, you only need to listen to, you know, one voice. And that, I think that's really hard. It's going to be hard to turn that tide because, I mean, I don't know.
Is it?
You'd be worried. Yes.
I would be worried, yes.
Oh, yeah.
But I'm thinking about this tide. And it's one of the things that's really important when you're dealing with the campaigns against education. What it is going to be, and I do not want to discount this, is damaging. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Whether or not we could turn the tide, I'm a little bit more optimistic in that regard, and here's why. The attacks, the structure upon which all of this is built on, the foundation is fickle. It's a foundation that's not crumbling. It's not there. And the ones that we stand on is. There is history, whether they like it or not.
Right.
There is a foundation that we have built. They want to discount that foundation and put in its place whatever it is they want because they feel like they own all of this and we were just here for the ride. That's always been, they've always had control and they've lost it. A lot of people don't recognize the fact that these are all the things that happen when you're losing everything that you said that was going to be here forever. We always talk, you had said it earlier. You never expected to see like fascism in the forefront. It would never happen here. Well, they never thought a black man would be president.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. They never thought that. They knew that, or I should say, they knew that it was going to happen one day and then it happened. And that was the beginning of all hell breaking loose, to be honest. They have always been trying to go after education. They've always tried to stifle that.
Yeah.
And now they feel that they can't anymore. I mean, come on. We just made Juneteenth a national holiday.
Yeah. Yeah.
That would have never happened 5 years ago. Just 5 years ago.
Yeah, that's true. And then look at how gay rights have changed and, you know, over just, you know, since that same time period, since the 70s. Yeah.
Now, I don't mean to cut you off, but I got to make a point about something.
Yeah.
Now, when we were in the 80s, there was always a lot of homophobia, even coming from, especially in the mainstream with the jokes and the culture.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, of course. 90s came along, that changed immediately. Well, yeah, somewhat immediately, I should say. That changed from when the AIDS epidemic happened, and people were not getting the treatment that they needed to get. They said, okay, we're changing the entire culture, damn it. And that's exactly what happened. But look at what happens too. They laid in wait for the most part, because they didn't have the culture on their side anymore. The religious right and all the conservatives didn't have the culture on their side, attacking the LGBTQ community.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, here's where we become our worst enemy. We had the TERFs amongst us, and they did come from us. And you had people who were always about progressive politics, all of a sudden making an exception when it came to the transgender community. Mm. And when that happened, when you saw that conflict, you could bet the right saw it and said, that's our end.
Right. Yeah.
That's our end.
The Heritage Foundation. Here comes the
floodgates. Go after gay rights again. This time they think they have a chance.
Yeah. The Heritage Foundation actually saw that, and they wrote a paper, I believe it was Heritage, that the key to attacking LGBT rights was to split trans from LGB.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what I saw. I remember one time I was speaking at a conference, an anti-racist conference, mind you, and there was a speaker that talked about the LGBTQ community. And I was like, wait a minute, something's missing. And then she did it again, and I was like, oh, fuck. So we had, and they wanted me to be on their podcast, and I was like, no. So what we're seeing now with the attack on the LGBTQ community more or less being revised or more or less being revitalized is it came because we allowed it to happen. And I think that's really what's important when we talk about not only the attacks on the LGBTQ community, but also Black history. Now, where did the term woke come from? Woke came from culturally minded Black people. Mm-hmm. And yeah, they're going to say they're going to be anti-woke. They've always have been. They used to call it political correctness, but since that stopped working, let's just be honest now that we can. So you have somebody like Christopher Rufo, who curiously is working as a senior fellow with the Manhattan Institute. Now, the Manhattan Institute was founded in 1977 by a billionaire who's, unfortunately, name I keep forgetting, and Casey, William Casey, who went on to become the head of the CIA years later. And the unspoken mission of the Manhattan Institute, although it was didn't have to speak, it was using the free market to undermine and diminish the gains of the civil rights movement and relocate African-Americans out of the urban areas. Now, relocating African-Americans out of the urban areas will probably sound like a good idea today, but in 1977, that's where all the Black political power was at. Mm-hmm. And you didn't have any really good Black representation in the suburbs, in the rural areas. So if you relocate us out, we have no power. So one of the things that they really targeted was education, and they still do. Mm-hmm. And bear in mind this too. How I just explained Manhattan Institute in a nutshell, they rely on what we call, they rely, their practices are all about what we address in critical race theory. They're all about what we're talking about, critical race theory. So you have an organization that is using critical race theory for real, making actually proving the theory by actually going after education, which they have been doing for years.
Yep.
And along comes Christopher Rufo. And Christopher Rufo is one of those guys. And this is where we really have a problem, because just like with the TERFs, the issue has been everybody just running with what Christopher Rufo said. Christopher Rufo actually said that they was going to bastardize the term critical race theory by making people think that Black history, teaching Black history, I mean, I'm just paraphrasing here, teaching history that is, as far as they're concerned, an alternative to what we have been taught is actually critical race theory. And it's a lie. And he said it was a lie, that they wanted the term critical race theory bastardized. And that's exactly what has been going on for the past year and a half. And we went with it. That is one of the things that really drives me up the wall. He said it was a lie from the jump. He made no bones about it. His Twitter post is still up saying it. And we said, okay, we'll do that. So the question now that we have to ask is Black people, who are our friends and who are our enemies? Because if you're running with something that somebody on the right is saying is a lie, is saying is part of their propaganda, does that mean that you are about their propaganda? And you're trying to play it cool. And that is one of the reasons why a lot of people of color are skeptical when it comes to white allies. So here's where I have to ask to both Brian, Marina, how do we reconcile that? As white allies, not we, as white allies, as y'all, how do y'all reconcile that?
Yeah.
I think I just scared y'all.
Yeah, well, it's difficult. It's a difficult thing to reconcile. It's hard to overcome. Part of this fear of teaching history is that somebody's going to be ashamed of, you know, their history. And I mean, my God, if you look back at history, like, it's full of stuff that a lot of people ought to be ashamed of. It's just,
right.
You know, I mean, God, you know, like, yeah, you know, Africans selling other Africans into slavery, and you can go anywhere with it, you know, but yeah, you know, the whole point isn't that it's one side against the other. It's like, you know, we're all like one thing, and we're all like working toward the same end, which if we want to prosper and flourish, then we need to do like what, you know, they were saying in that book, How We Got Rich. You know, everybody counts. Everybody's like working together. And just like, you know, when I was in the service, you know, I loved all the guys that I worked with, and we were all from like different backgrounds. And you know, once we got together and understood each other's humanity, maybe that's the key. Maybe it's just, you know, looking each other in the eye and saying, you know, here's a guy that's a brother or a son or a daughter or, you know, whatever. And mm-hmm. you know, they got people that care about them. And the reason is that they're somebody that deserves to be cared about.
Right.
I think the question that Daryl asked, I've been thinking a lot about the 80s and how the Black activists and the white underground work together, and sort of a byproduct of that seems to be the Certain Days calendar, which talks about Black revolutionaries. Like every day you see where something awful happened, a Black massacre or some act of resistance. I like to see history as acts of resistance against oppressive power. I don't really look at, you know, white history or even American history as looking at the politicians. I see where people stood up, where people were brave, and that predominantly is oppressed people, Black people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my history is Howard Zinn's People History. I think that maybe starts to put my heart in the right place. And one thing I have to say is that as a person, I am a canvas for what's around me. I find myself, when I go 40 miles north to Sherbrooke, where there's a lot of Black people, I react differently than if I see a Black person in the Northeast Kingdom. And that's something that's inside this psyche, whether it's just as a human seeing someone that's not that seems a different place, or whether it's internalized racism. I don't really know, but I think that's something we need to think about, is how we become the canvases for what's good and what's bad in society. And we have to be aware of that. Right. I think that's a start.
I think I'm always the kind of guy that tries to formulate a plan, that tries to say flat out, this is what we got to do. And I think the attacks on education, the attacks on Black history, especially, attacks on history in general, really does have to stop. I mean, when they say that a math course in Florida has to be abolished in the name of, because it promoted critical race theory, there's a problem. Because ironically, while they're sitting there talking about how the LGBTQ community is threatening kids, they're going into the schools and doing far worse than anybody in the LGBT community has ever done, which is very easy considering that the LGBTQ community has not threatened kids. But I digress. I look at the fact that recently, you're talking about history courses that are being challenged because they make white people look bad. That's a Hitler move.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
Hitler did that. Hitler said that the Jews were making Germans, of course he meant white people, look bad, or they're perpetuating a threat against Germans. And we did it here, actually, to Germans.
Yeah.
And that's how we...
And the Japanese.
I mean, we made them look like they were threatening us.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And they do it all the time, the Black people, all the time. We are supposed to be their threat. But when you, it's one thing when you want to cry about Black crime, but the crime rate has gone down. So guess what? Now education is a threat. Openly, they're saying being educated about ourselves is a threat. So here's what we got to do. We got to get in their face and we got to stop them. We got to make sure there is more and more and more Black representation, brown representation, yellow representation, red representation, just more representation of all of us across the board, period. And that is what they're calling woke culture. Because here's the fun thing about it. I hear online them complaining about woke culture, but they complain about it when they see it, which means it's already happening. And it's not even happening when it's political. It's not a political move. It's just the fact that we are becoming more and more a part of today's society. We're contributing more, we're growing more. I mean, but the complaint about things being woke when the truth is all you saw was a darker face than yours, it should be easy for us to push back on that beyond the internet, because that's where you see all of this nonsense. And when you turn off the internet and you try to fight back against that kind of crap, all of a sudden the strength is gone. All of a sudden nobody wants to do anything, because we got to rely on the wrong people that we elected into office. So it's kind of like we also have to start recognizing that whatever it is that we as a society want, it hasn't really been reflecting all that well in our votes, and that's got to change. I mean, I'm not always the biggest cheerleader to go out there and vote, but A, I do vote, and B, now you know why. So, with the little bit of time that we have left, what do you say to encourage people to get out there and do what needs to be done, regardless of whether or not it's voting or anything like that? What do you say to people, and how, you don't have to necessarily say, just like I did, a specific thing, but what do you say in particular to try to encourage people that we can beat this?
Yeah, I'd say we're all better working together, and mm-hmm. democracy requires that. It requires everybody do their homework and know what's going on, pay attention to, you know, real news and less on propaganda and less crap you see maybe posted on social media. You know, we're a country, we're not a country that was founded by any particular, you know, race so much, you know, like we've had these immigrants coming in over 200 years. And over that time, we become more and more democratic, allowing more different groups to vote. And, and to have more freedoms. And if we want to continue that, and if we want to get to the point where we're flourishing as a nation again, we've all got to see, you know, we've got to all see that we're in this together, that we're all human, and see the humanity in everybody, and that we need everybody, you know, performing at their best. And it's not about shaming somebody. It's about learning from the past. That's why we learn about history. You know, you put your hand on a hot stove and burn it, and you learn not to do that again. And this is, it's as simple as that. You know, we've got to look at the past, look at our mistakes. Doesn't matter what, you know, color or what gender the person was that made a mistake. Just learn not to repeat that, and think about ourselves as this country that's bound by ideals, hopefully positive ideals. I always, like one of the songs that I think of is that, you know, the Hollies tune, "He Ain't Heavy, He's My Brother." That's about caring for one another. That's what I believe America's about, is all these people came to this country because they were being discriminated against one way or another, you know, where they came from, or they had hard times. And this is a place where you know, they can live their dream, and we can still make it that kind of place, but we got to give each other a break.
Right. All right.
Let's do plugs. Daryl, what, we didn't even get a chance. We got into the conversation before you really introduced yourself, but.
Well, I'm Daryl Lamont Jenkins. I am the founder and executive director of One People's Project. And I have another podcast called The Art of Boxing Poetry that shows up on YouTube or in other places every now and again. You can find us on idavox.com, onepeoplesproject.com. There is also Twitter accounts. Yes, I have Twitter accounts. I'm D Lamont. I'm at D Lamont Jenkins, and Idavox is at Idavox OPP, and One People's Proj, PROJ, leave out the ECT. So, and of course, you can find us on Facebook, and you can find us on, I think you can find us on, no, you can find me on Twitch, but I don't do anything on Twitch. I don't do anything on TikTok, but I have that too. So you just look for me. All right. And donate. We need money. Yeah. Cash App is One People's Project, and it's also Venmo. And well, actually, just hit onepeoplesproject.com. You see a big fat donate button, and I'm done.
Well, there's one more thing. What are we doing in November? Where do we need?
Yeah, then go? There's that.
Yeah.
Right. November, we have from November 18th to 20th, there's going to be a white supremacist conference called the American Renaissance Conference. It's been going on for over 9 years. And we're going to have Congress people speaking at this thing. Former Congressman Steve King is going to be there. And Congress wannabe by the name of Laura Loomer, an anti-Muslim activist, well, anti-everything activist, just straight up fascist. It's a fascist conference that we've been trying to shut down for years. We chased it out of D.C., we chased it out of Charlotte, North Carolina, but they seem to find a home just outside Nashville. Mm. They need your help. People in Tennessee need your help. So let's give it to them. You want to learn more about that? Hit up One People's Project. We'll be able to give you the links if you go to the sidebar about that particular conference. You'll see calendar events. Look for the American Renaissance Conference, and you'll see.
So, Brian, do you have anything you want to plug before we wrap up?
Well, just, you know, support your educators. I I have a blog, The Progressive Historian, and it's at theprogressivehistorian.com that just has some of my editorial letters talking about just things that, you know, came to mind, you know, during the last 4 or 5 years. And, but overall, just I want people to really know that teachers really do care about your kids. And we're in it because we're not in it for the money, that's for sure. We're in it because we care about the next generation. We care about them learning about what's going on in this world so that they have a fighting chance to, because they're the ones they're going to take over. And they're the ones that are going to have to help make things right, fix the things that our generation screwed up. So, you know, support your teachers. They're not out to hurt your kids. Teachers are in it for the right reasons.
Many thanks to Bill McCray and to Daryl Lamont Jenkins. This was Vermont Movement News, Volume 3, Episode 1. Welcome back, everybody.